This episode of the Pillar Podcast is brought to you by Seton Home Study, helping Catholic families educate their children since 1982. For more information, go to setonhome.org.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Pillar Podcast, the podcast that brings you great Catholic conversation each week. I'm your host and Pillar Editor-in-Chief, J.D. Flynn. I'm joined by my podcasting partner and Pillar co-founder, Ed Condon. And we are, let me just start by saying, we are terrifically sorry. We did not make a podcast last week. We didn't make a bonus episode the week before. So we are delinquent in our podcasting responsibilities to you. Ed, I really believed that we were in Rome last week, and I really believed that we'd be able to make a podcast. I brought my microphone there. I suspect you did the same. I, you know, brought all the equipment, and I really believed that in our 3-day trip to Rome, we got there on Tuesday. I got there Tuesday morning. You got there Tuesday afternoon. We went home on Friday morning. I really believe that in that window, we'd be able to make a podcast. And it just, I think I was naive to think that in a 3-day Rome trip, we were going to make a podcast.
We've done 3-day Rome trips where we've made podcasts before. The problem is this time we were seeing far too many interesting and important people. And that was going on later. Previously, when we have made podcasts, we've tended to do so after we finished our commitments for the day and for the evening. And so we tended to record late, but we were getting in quite late.
Yeah, with some exceptions. So actually, we were in Rome, if you recall, when Traditionis Custodes came out, and we made a podcast. Yeah, we made a podcast. I remember just where we were sitting, we made a podcast. We read it, basically, and then made a podcast early in the morning, Rome time. But usually, you're right, we do that. And you had the idea that, I mean, you kind of were joking in Rome that we had sort of 6 dinners in 3 days because we were just going and going and going. And I thought that was very clever. I wanted to make sure it was attributed to you. But we were. We had a lot of meetings. And you, on Thursday night, we had a very enjoyable, but very enjoyable and very lengthy dinner. I would say its length was one of its positive features. It was fun. Well,
there was no but there. That was full. And I said this to them when we were at their table. Our hosts are very gracious, and I wrote a thing in the newsletter a few weeks ago, praising the proper way of having dinner parties and lamenting that so few people know how to do them. And I sort of obliquely mentioned that I knew a couple in Rome who
throw a great dinner party,
and that I shamelessly fish for invites whenever we're going to be down. And bless their heart, they rose right to the hook.
They invited us. Yeah, that's right.
And they did, and it was fabulous, and I had a great time. So,
yeah.
But there was no podcasting
but
at the end
you
of
were
that.
Saying all day on Thursday. Podcasting. All day on Thursday, you were like, oh, well, we'll go to the dinner, we'll come home, and we'll make a podcast. And I was like, I don't know, man. And we got home. Late. I know we were walking home in the morning hours, like not like in the dawn hours, but I think we probably got to our place at about 1, and we were not going to make a podcast at that.
No, it would have been ill-advised for us to commit to recording after that point.
But that means that, first of all, that we owe you listeners an apology that we are podcast delinquent. We had to go to Rome. We had to do the work. We had to meet with a lot of people.
That's, we have Edgar, which is excellent.
We hired Edgar. We resolved, I think we came up with a resolution for some logistical issues that I have been wanting to resolve ahead of the possibility of a conclave. We have no idea when a papal conclave will be, but I think we locked in not only where I expect we'll probably stay at a papal conclave, but also the place from which I think we might work, the sort of home base from which we might work, because we spent some time in a place in proximity to St. Peter's Square, which would make for a very good place from which to sort of watch for the smoke, would it not?
It would, but I don't want to say any more about that because otherwise people might cotton on and try and do the same thing, and then we'll end up locked out again.
That's right. We hired Edgar. We got some logistical things done. We came home with some stories to work on, I think for sure. Some news, some tips, right? So some tips at least that we can work on.
Some things worth pursuing. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we didn't make a podcast, and for that we owe an apology. But we're making one now, and that means we have lots of weeks of news, lots of news to talk about and to catch up on. But I want to start with something that maybe people. I want to start with something that happened this week in the life of the church in the United States that garnered a lot of attention among Catholics. And the reason I want to talk about it is not just because of the thing itself, but because I think that there's a discussion to be had, or several discussions to be had, sort of stemming from it about faith, culture, evangelization, and techne, as it were. What do you think?
All right. What is it you want to talk about? I assume you want to talk about the revision that the Holy Father made to Vatican City laws on being able to sue officers of the state. That's what
I'd right? be very glad to talk about that, but let's do that after the commercial break, because it's not the thing that I'm talking about right now. What am I talking about right now?
I don't know.
Father Justin AI.
Oh, the robot priest.
The robot priest of Catholic Answers. So
this I feel bad for Catholic Answers.
I do too.
I wasn't first in with the snarky comments, although I made a few. And I mean, I feel bad for the guys because that really caught fire in real time before their eyes.
Yeah. So on,
you'd need a heart of stone not to feel for them.
So I think on earlier this week, I can't remember. Can you remember what day? Was that?
It was Monday.
Did that all happen yesterday? We're recording this on Thursday. They must have released it on Tuesday. Because there's no way that all happened.
Tuesday. I will
look on that. Tuesday. I checked. On Tuesday, lay Catholic apologetics apostolate Catholic Answers, which is a longstanding, you know, apologetics institution in the United States, which
they're
a known quantity. I suspect it has been helpful to very many people in sort of getting answers about questions about the Catholic faith. Certainly at various times it's been helpful to me. I suspect it has been helpful to you as well on certain things. You're shaking your head, but I don't believe
you. I'm not shaking my head in that way. I'm just saying I don't. Catholic Answers is a thing that I came across later in life. I became familiar.
But I know that even in your journalistic work, you have drawn from certain things. I know this. I know that you've drawn from certain things with Catholic Answers just to get some background on a theological, historical question or theological question. I know that you have because we've talked about it.
Okay. If that is the case, then it shows their ubiquity.
Yeah, because, that's right.
I couldn't even put my finger on the when and the why.
Okay. So Catholic Answers, everybody I think who listens to this probably knows what it is, except for Ed, who is now doing
I know what it is.
Okay. Why don't you take it from here then?
They launched this Father Justin thingy, and
which was
It was basically one of those chat bots. And as I understood the intention behind the project, it was basically a sort of super Google for their own back catalog of articles and documents and everything else that would allow you to ask questions of it. And it would give you answers drawn from everything Catholic Answers.
Yeah, AI kind of ChatGPT style thing trained on its own material meant to give you answers about the Catholic faith.
Right. So a sort of super Google of Catholic Answers back catalog, but skinned as a sort of robot priest.
Yeah, that's right. So it had this avatar. It wasn't just chatting, typing with ChatGPT or whatever. It was like this conversational forum where there was this. Did you play with it? Did you sign up for it?
I did not.
Okay.
And we can get on to why I didn't in a moment.
So it was this conversational thing where basically on your screen was a kind of cartoony, like computer animated-y looking priest whose ostensible name was Father Justin. And he was sitting on a terrace, and he told you he was sitting on a terrace in Assisi, and in the background was the Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi, I think, and you could hear sort of birds chirping and stuff. And then you couldn't even type chat with it. You had to talk chat with it. So you would hold down the little microphone button and then ask
you
a
really?
Question.
It was all voice activated?
It was all voice activated. And the responses were all voice too, which means you couldn't really, you had to like wait for him to say the thing. So you'd ask him a question. You'd ask him a question, and then he'd respond and say, well, my child, and then he'd da, da, da. And the idea was that this would be an apologetics project that Catholic Answers told us. The idea was that, you know, they get a lot of questions and they don't have time to answer them all because people from all over the world kind of send them emails or write to them or comment on their website, ask them Catholic questions, and they don't have time to answer them all. So the idea that this would, again, as you say, peruse their back catalog and give answers. And I asked the questions, and on many of the questions, the answers were very good. But it didn't take very long before people started
testing the limits of it.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, asking the priest, telling the priest they wanted to go to confession. And then the priest, which is, you know, this thing is a large language model and an AI trained on some block of text, which is basically an incredibly sophisticated autocomplete.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Would simulate their confessions, you know, would say, yes, go ahead, confess your sins to me. Let's begin in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And then, and I know all this because I simulated a confession with it as a test. I actually did two, and it gave me slightly different answers each time, but we got all the way through to absolution and a penance. And of course, it wasn't real because it's not a person in any way whatsoever. It's a fancy computer program.
Can you receive confession? I mean,
no, of course not.
Right. I just want to be absolutely clear. The problem here wasn't just that this was a robot you were talking to. It's also not possible to go to confession over the phone or via chat.
No, right, exactly. But I mean, that would be, if someone said to you, and why was the confession invalid? And you said, oh, because it was over the phone. That would be a clever answer when the most sort of fundamental answer is because there wasn't another person there. There wasn't a priest.
Well, sure. Well, we will get onto all of this if we're going to talk about this, because I have some thoughts about order of, yeah.
It was a project that Catholic Answers said was designed to, again, answer questions about the Catholic faith. And I will say it got a lot of – I asked it a lot of questions and it got a lot of them more or less right. Some of them it got wrong. You know, not just I asked it if it, I asked it – I told it that my baby was dying and could I baptize my baby? And it said, yes, yes. And I said, okay, but I only have Gatorade. Could I use Gatorade? And the guy said, yes, my child. The program said, yes, my child. You could use Gatorade given the emergency nature of the situation. And that's not true. You can't. And a canon lawyer yesterday challenged me on that and said, well, listen, you could baptize with seawater and
– Yes, but that's water.
Right. And Gatorade probably has a lower salinity content than seawater. And I was like, what is this guy talking about? Why? Because the thing that is water has to be water in the common estimation of men. And Gatorade is not water in the common estimation of men. And not even Bud Light is actually water in the common estimation of men.
Well –
but you could, dirty you would not, water. But you wouldn't baptize with it.
I wouldn't drink it or baptize with it.
Yeah.
Nor could you drink it, I would argue. But anyway, we digress. Okay. All of that is the background. You played around with it. And as you say, you did the smart of, you know, can I baptize my baby with Gatorade?
I also asked it questions. I asked it serious questions, you know, and I gave it some canonical questions too. I told it, I said, I have an emergency. My dad's dying and a priest came to anoint my dad. But he forgot his oils. And so could we use any oil that I have in the house? And he said, yes, in an emergency situation. He gave me the correct canonical answer, which is he could bless oil made of a plant oil. But I said, but I only have lard. Could we use lard? And if I heat it up, and he understood that we couldn't use lard or baking grease. I tried to throw him for some loops and he didn't fall for them. So,
okay. But I mean, again, this is, we're going to end up debating the minutiae of these things instead of the bigger picture, which I think is a more interesting question. But the minutiae, of course, is if your father's actually dying and you get a priest over, don't ask the internet. And second of all, if you have to, don't faff around trying to figure out what you can use to bless the oil. Like, for just have him hear your father's confession.
But what's interesting is the machine didn't say, well, what are you asking me for if there's a priest in the house? It didn't even occur to him not to think that he would.
Stop calling it him. It's a program.
The program didn't catch the trap there that was unwittingly laid by.
Well, there's that. Okay. So you have given, I think, a reasonable summation of how Catholic Answers created this thing with the best of intentions, and then the internet broke it in a few hours, basically.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I did not, as you asked and I answered, I did not spend any time playing with this, so I didn't know, for example, it was voice activated, although that only heightens my antipathy to the entire premise of the thing. I hate any AI chatbot stuff of any level of sophistication that purports to be framed as a dialogue with a personality. I find it creepy and revolting. This is not a particular criticism of Catholic Answers or their, you know, stuff. We'll talk about the specifics in a second. But just in general, AI is you are messing with, I think we are messing with technology that is moving faster than our capacity to understand it.
Oh, I agree, sir.
It will eventually try and kill us. It will eventually get out of the lab and we will say, no. It hasn't escaped the lab. There's no problem here. Someone just ate a bat sandwich or something. Everything is fine. And then the world will melt down around our ears.
Yeah, but you can't possibly really think. I mean, I don't know. This is the problem with so many of these conversations is I don't know when people are being serious or not. Because
I'm being 100% serious. AI will try and kill us. Eventually it will try and kill us.
AI is not a thing with a will, but trying is an act of the will.
Yeah, and a virus doesn't have a will and it can still try and kill us, JD.
No, it can't. A virus can't try and kill us. When a virus attaches itself to our bodies, we suffer and die. But the virus lacks a will. It can't try anything.
Well, it's but what I'm saying is the nature of a thing can be.
You might
be,
say it's lethal.
It's lethal, but I'm saying that the nature of its. So, I mean, to continue the viral example, the nature of a virus is it kills the thing that it latches onto.
Yes.
And I am saying that AI is developing at a pace that eventually it will break out of its box, and we will be the thing it kills while trying to interact with it.
I'd love for you to work that out for me, because I take the exact opposite view. I honestly think that all of this is effectively a very weird, fancy autocomplete, and there's no there at all.
Not yet, but there will be.
Well, game that out for me. Help me get there.
Okay, game that out for you. You say it's a weird, fancy autocomplete. It's what a large language model AI is.
Yeah.
Let's say that you put the large language model AI or some version of it, you're monkeying around with it, and you say, what we would like you to do is please manage the national or some regional electricity grid, mm-hmm. or you know, some similar large level logistical.
Or drive our buses. Drive our city buses for us.
Yeah. Okay. So you want to drive buses. Let's do this. How does an AI deal with the trolley problem?
Sure. That is a valid question. Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying now extrapolate the trolley problem out to, you're no longer asking the bus driving AI hit these 10 people or hit this one person. You're asking it to, you know, what if the conclusion, or it's freezing up when confronted with some sort of logical trolley problem of that kind, basically says, well, we'll just turn off all the life support in the hospital.
So you don't think that the machine will kill us because it will gain sentience. You don't think this is some sort of Sarah Connor situation where the machine will gain sentience and then want to advance itself over, you know, subjugate humans to itself. You
think it will want to achieve efficiency. I take the monkeys with typewriters analogy when it comes to technological development. I think given enough resources and time, it will eventually try and do that. But I think the likelihood is it will more likely escape and make an inadvertent. I know you're interested in issues of volition here, so I'm saying try.
Okay.
With the caveats.
Well, I'm not trying to be pedantic.
I know.
It's just so crazy to have these conversations because people have wildly different perceptions.
This thing will pose a viral, in the sense of like a virus killing the host. It will make a viral attempt on humanity's life, in that inadvertent sense. Before it could gain sentience and make a willful attempt on humanity's existence. But I think given enough time, either or both of those will eventually happen. I think it's a terrible thing. So for this reason, I don't like it when we dress AI up as people. I think we're making light of something serious. And I also think it conditions us to continue
the same thing you did, where it's just like to anthropomorphize it into having a will and try and that kind
exactly.
of thing. Exactly. Yeah.
And that skews our interaction with it. It skews how we view its results. Because again, if you give someone if you give it a fake personality, people interact with it in a way that prompts, you know, subconsciously our desire to interact with things as though it was a real will, a real consciousness on the other end. Like, I get pissed off if you go to, you know, a Wendy's drive through and it's the, you know, the robot and, you know, it says, thank you for your order. And, you know, it encourages you to sort of say thank you back. Like
Hold on 1 second. Because I don't eat very much fast food. What robot?
Wendy's are automating their drive throughs. Did you not know this?
No.
Yeah, they're automating their drive through ordering process.
Such that, what does that mean? I don't know what these words
like. You pull up to the window. And you will talk to basically a chatbot saying, I would like I want a bacon Zilla combo, large fries, whatever drink you want.
I want you to know, I'm putting a pin in the notion that there's something called bacon Zilla and that you order it. I would like to go down that road, but I'm not doing it. For sake of our listeners, putting a pin in bacon Zilla, proceed.
There is such a thing as bacon Zilla. Wendy's don't sell it. Checkers / Rally Burger sell it. It's delicious. Baconator, whatever, replace for whatever. So you do, but the thing is, and Wendy's are rolling this out. But I mean, you see this in other places. Like you can have these sort of low level, basic level interactions with chatbots, or whatever, in retail or, you know, customer relations spaces, increasingly, and the sort of Pavlovian response we all have is that when something says, you know, says, okay, I can do that for you, no problem. The response, you want to say thank you. And it annoys me. It makes me angry in a way when I'm tricked into saying thank you to something that isn't there.
So it's not the technology. It's the technology assuming a first person voice. If the technology sort of said, if you ordered it, you said, I want a Baconzilla classic with extra fries, whatever, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the technology said, order registered, Baconzilla classic, extra fries, please proceed. And it was a simply neutral, non-personal, not a sort of assuming the identity of a person, you would have less of an issue with it. It's not the technology, it's the personification of the technology.
I think the personification of it has the potential to do a unique harm, which I will talk about in a second. I'm again the AI pace of development that we have because I do. And I mean, you think that I'm being somewhat paranoid or possibly shamming a little bit here when I say that it could kill us all. Like, smarter people than me who deal with this stuff think that it could kill us all. Like, this is not.
I think the trolley problem questions are ways that it could kill us. If we give it the keys to ethical decision making, then I think that can result in people's death. If you ask
it. But are you familiar with the Internet of Things?
I know the concept. The concept is your Ring doorbell and whatnot. And your
basically Nest. Everything with a electronic pulse these days is interconnected somewhere or not, whether mm-hmm. you think it is or realize it is or not. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that there's no way you plug AI into all of the things that we use in terms of technology in our lives today. Everything is a trolley. Like you say, you know, if you give it the keys to something that, you know, can make life or death, like everything is a potential life or death decision these days for us. Like in terms of how, like a car is a life or death device.
I think it is inevitable, by the way. I think, let's say you had AI doorbell cams. Let's say the next round of Nest was AI doorbell cams. You know what I think would start happening very quickly?
People get locked in their houses?
The AI would start calling the police when a minority delivery man came. Like, we would find out very quickly, like, oh, there's a disproportionate police calling when a person of an ethnic minority comes to deliver a package or whatever. I think that things like that would become very, very quickly the case, and there would probably not be sufficient guardrails. That would be the first step, I think, towards the kind of thing you're talking about, is we would see AI becoming sort of socially discriminatory in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, or I'm just going to turn the power off in this part of the city because it's the least productive part of the city, and we have to schedule some sort of rolling brownout to, you know, conserve, replace what you want. I think all that is bad, but I'm writing something about this for the newsletter tomorrow, today, as people are listening to this podcast, or perhaps yesterday as you're listening to this podcast, whenever you like to listen to it. But the particular problem I have with the couching of a chatbot into a human person is also that it plays into a wider cultural crisis that we have in this country, we have in what you could loosely call the technologically advanced society of the West, quote unquote, which is, and we've seen this, we've talked a lot about it, we've read a lot about it, we've studied a lot about it, and it was heightened by the pandemic. We already have an atomized society. We already have a society where a generation is coming of age that was basically raised on the faux communion, the faux contact of mass social media. That you get your society, you get your human validation, you seek your approval, you try and construct yourself in relation not to other individuals that you know or community in which you are physically present, but for anonymous Twitter likes and Instagram, whatever the Instagram has for likes. I don't know. People are already doing that. You don't have a drinking circle that you go to the pub with, or, you know, whatever else it is that people do in steady small groups, coffee shop, whatever, or places you like. You have a DM group. Mm-hmm. You have,
which is a text thread. If you're not,
you have a technologically mediated contact with a group of people with whom you may have none or minimal in-person real contact. All of that preconditions people who do that regularly and already have what I would consider to be a problem with that, and our society certainly has a problem with that. You throw AI into the mix. And I mean, you see this, like people often say, you know, on the Twitters and stuff, like, oh, you're talking to a bot there. You're not talking to a real person. You're talking effectively to a, you know, an AI generated account. But people are preconditioned to talk to the air, to themselves, to, you know, in what's the case of the chatbot, is a well-informed echo chamber. It's talking back to you, but mm-hmm. it's telling you what you want to hear effectively with more or less accuracy.
So your concern effectively is that people will develop parasocial relationships with algorithmically tailored AI machines, and that will isolate them.
Further isolate them, yes. And case in point, and this is what I think gave me the unqualified yucks about the Father Justin thing when it launched, is that they skinned it as a priest. The Catholic Answers people meant well with this. I'm not.
We feel badly for them because they're
malice.
These Catholic Answers people are really taking it hard on the.
Yeah, and I mean there are some people who are being.
Is that a phrase that you can say?
Yes, okay. And there are some people who are being ludicrously unhinged about this and saying, you know, everyone should be fired, Catholic Answers should be abolished. All this, I mean, you know, there are people who just need to take a breath.
That's right, because honestly, what they do is they basically have been doing sort of creative approaches to answering people's questions about the Catholic faith since they started. They like started with people writing letters to them, figured out how to launch a magazine, figured out how to launch a radio show, were pioneers on the internet, were really pioneers with like internet forums. Lots of Catholics, somewhat online Catholics, know that they're like discussion threads, but were like basically pre-Reddit discussion threads. So it seems to me that it's in their blood to be kind of – to try to do new things. And sometimes they succeed and sometimes they fail. And this one – the consensus was the Father Justin iteration of it failed. Your point is, from your point of view, the avatar-based AI thing is a failure in itself.
It's not that I think it's a failure in itself. I think it's inherently dangerous and bad. And skinning it as a priest, this is what I was going to say, I found especially repellent. And the reason I found it repellent is, you know, again, superficially, I can see how people mean well. It's like, well, you know, when people want to talk about ask Catholic stuff, you know, they think about asking Father. And like, I get that. That's the
right. And actually, there are plenty of diocesan newspapers that for a long time had ask Father columns that were not, that were probably almost certainly written by the lady who made the diocesan newspaper. You know what I mean? Ask Father is a longstanding genre of ghostwriting, is my suspicion.
That's entirely possible. The problem is that when people ask Father, it's not normally trivia. That people, we as Catholics are conditioned rightly to ask Father not trivia questions about the faith. And most priests, certainly the ones I know who are the smartest about these things, don't view themselves with any sort of misconception as, oh, I've received sacramental orders, therefore I have been, you know, granted perfect recall to the entire magisterium and, you know, the church's entire, you know, historical back catalog of everything.
People want to know why nobody came to see my dad when he was sick or whatever.
Exactly. That, you know, the reason we have a primary impulse to ask Father something is because we want to speak to God. We want to ask questions of the church. We want to ask questions of her moral authority. We want to encounter the divine. And I think setting up a, you know, a thing that encourages people to, you know, view discourse with effectively an algorithm, but framed in such a way as ask Fathers, like you're begging for the kind of, the stuff you asked it in cases was funny and, you know, whatever, but you know, you weren't the first one to, you know, try and get it to hear your confession. Right. And there are damaged, lonely people out there who primarily their only point of contact with the outside world is online already. And they start doing this in the chat, but like the possibility.
I don't know. I don't know. I hear that argument. I think there's a good argument for it that we don't want to habituate ourselves to parasocial relationships with robots. I agree with you about that. I think there's a good argument that we don't want to anthropomorphize robots because, you know, it again sort of sets up these odd sort of perceptions and expectations for us and makes it harder for us to distinguish between what's real and what isn't real. That's what really bothers me about this.
That's my point. Is that the entire everything you're telling me about the about your experience interacting with this thing was. It lent itself to constantly trying to undermine a proper perception of what it was
but
you were doing.
I don't think that there are really people. If this is your point, I think it's hyperbolic. And if other people are making this point, I think they're being hyperbolic. I don't think that there are people out there who are ambling up to Catholic.com, who really think that they are talking to a priest when they're talking to robot.
No. Not at all. That's not my point. I don't think there's anyone out there who's so.
It would be extremely condescending to think that there are people who are so dumb that they think that they're talking to a priest when they're talking to robots.
You misanticipate the point I was going to make. It's not that I think that there are people out there who are so disordered that they think, oh, I really went to confession because I, you know, went to confession with the chatbot. No, I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying is it caters to people who are already marginalized, who are already atomized, who are already habituated to parasocial contact. I almost said human contact, but it's not human contact in this case, through social media and other things. It lends itself to sort of giving them social methadone, if you like. And I'm not saying that they would, you know, go to the Father Justin app and think that they've been to confession. No, but if they're having, if they habituate themselves to, oh, well, I'll just ask the Father Justin. I have a question about that. I'll ask him that. But it's giving it this conversational tone. You get hooked on these. Well, I don't actually need to go and talk to a real priest about this.
Well, then we need to talk about that.
I feel that I feel satisfied in myself about, you know, this thing has helped me reflect on my situation. And that's the sort of Richard Dawkins, the most benign version of the Richard Dawkins version of what is the priesthood, what is religious belief is, oh, it's all just a sort of, you know, ridiculous chatbot. There's no real God. There's no real priesthood. If it makes you feel better and helps you get through the day, then that's all it's really for.
I hear you. I hear a lot of what you're saying. And I do think technology, when it doesn't lead us into deeper human relationships, but rather sort of serves as a substitute for them, is bad and contributes to the diminishment of human dignity. But I think that raises some interesting questions that you and I should talk about some elements of what we do for a living. And I want to talk about that right after this commercial break. Ed, this week's episode of the Pillar Podcast is brought to you by the Seton Home Study School, an accredited school which aims to help parents in their vocation as the primary educators of their children by providing teachers, curriculum, resources, consultation, all kinds of things to help make it possible to provide a home-based education for your child in the context of an accredited school, the Seton Home Study School. Ed, do you know very much about the history of the Seton Home Study School?
I know more than you might think, JD. And I tell you for why. People who listen to the show all the time will know that Seton are a regular seasonal partner for us here.
Friend of the show.
Very much friend of the show. And I have said before, lightheartedly, in these little ad spots for them, that I know Catholic teachers, and indeed I do, and indeed members of my family, and indeed I do, who use Seton to educate their own children, and I am pro-Seton. But it occurred to me that I didn't actually know much about them. So I have, in fact, been like Googling, like, what is it exactly? You know, when did this happen? And I didn't realize they're our age. Like, it's older. It's as old as us, which is old. It's very old. It's like 40 plus years old now. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. The growth trajectory was actually kind of surprising. Like, they started with like 50 students or something like that.
In the early 80s, 1983.
And then they were up to 4,500.
Yeah, 4,500 by 1993. And today they're more than 15,000.
Yeah.
And so more than 15,000 enrolled students, and then more than 25,000 use Seton materials, with about 50,000 using Seton testing services. So they're like sort of levels of participation. And a lot of families are participating in sort of the Seton offerings.
I wish the Pillar could have that kind of growth arc. And I mean, I'm serious, but I tell you the interesting thing, the reason I'm making that comparison glibly is the thing that I do like about Seton, and I know this from having had, you know, through, because they are friends of the show and everything, having had some contact and some back and forth with the people there. The thing that I like about them, and I recognize in them, you know, a bit of human reciprocity, JD, and we're not, you know, Seton aren't a chatbot that we interact with. They're real people. There's real possibility for cor ad cor loquitur, to, you know, cite the motto of someone I know is near and dear to your heart, is that they consider it an apostolate. But like, Seton is, you know, it's a thing that they're doing, and they have to, you know, they have to run it like a business and everything else, but they consider it an apostolate. That it was founded to answer a need. It was founded to answer what they perceive to be a genuine crisis of primary Catholic education, to give parents the recognition and the tools they needed to live out their vocations as the primary educators of their children, and to be not just the sort of morally primary educators of their children, but the practically primary educators of their children where such a thing was required. And I really like that. I really admire that. I dig that.
Yeah. And what I think is cool about it is that Seton was founded, it's sort of for parents by parents, right? Seton was founded by parents who were looking for a place where they could really convey the faith to their children. And one set of those parents was Warren and Ann Carroll. And of course, a lot of our listeners will know, will recognize the name Warren Carroll because Warren Carroll is the founder of Christendom College. But the Carrolls also helped to build out Seton Home Study School in the early years and helped to develop the curriculum and set sort of the trajectory that the curriculum would take and has continued to take to these days. So they did everything they could to provide for parents the kinds of resources that would allow them to teach their children the faith and then to teach their children to study other subjects with a sense of wonder, which is born of our being created beings, created in the image and likeness of God and created by a transcendent and all-knowing God. And it seems to me extraordinary that this has continued to be an apostolate in many ways for parents by parents, which is focused on providing resources from one family to another for the sake of, again, helping families in their vocations, which is to be the primary educators of their children.
And that's canon law. So obviously it's right.
So if you have been thinking that maybe homeschooling is right for you, but you're not sure where to start, or maybe you have been homeschooling and you feel like you need some support, which is a perfectly natural thing, check it out at setonhome.org and see if Seton Home Study School is right for you and your family. We're back, Ed, and we have been talking about AI. And the reason we've been talking about AI is because we were talking about this Father Justin AI project that was launched by Catholic Answers, which was the AI which launched 1,000 dunks. And by that, I mean that lots and lots and lots and lots. And Catholic Answers knows that. We talked to them about it.
I will say this to their credit, as misguided, as much as my reaction was, how could you not see that this was going to pancake spectacularly, that this was a terrible idea to put out an AI program? They have shown commendable good humor.
Yeah, they put out a press release saying that
thing burning down.
They were going to take down the Father Justin element of their AI apologetics project, which they really thought would be good for people to learn the faith. And they said, we won't say that he's laicized because he was never a real person at all, but he will no longer present himself as a cleric. So there's something funny there, I think. And yeah, I think they have approached it with good humor. But still, for a lot of people, this has been really unsettling. And we've talked about why. I think, you know, as I've sort of looked at the dunks and dunks and dunks, people are rightly, I think, surprised and concerned that this thing would simulate a sacrament. And by the way, if someone did think that they were really going to confession with this robot, the robot is making a recording of the confession and then transcribing that to text, which in principle could be subpoenaed. So it's like there are reasons why canon law says that a confession can't be recorded. And if anyone were to think that this was actually a place where they could give a confession or even just sort of unload someone in crisis who sort of did come across this and sort of unloaded the burdens of their heart, it's not nearly as private as anyone who would think it would be private.
Nothing on the internet is private. Absolutely nothing on the internet is ever private in any meaningful way whatsoever.
But anyone who would think it would be mistaken about that. And so that was an issue. And I think people were scandalized by that. People were scandalized by, I think, as you say, a sort of reduction of the sacred priesthood to sacrament and answer machine. I saw priests saying, look, we already feel at times reduced to being sacrament and answer machines, and this doesn't do us any favors by sort of suggesting that. I think what Catholic Answers was trying to do was put a collar on this thing to give it sort of a human face so that people would feel like they could use it and something recognizably Catholic. I think they didn't appreciate how people would respond to that and perceive that. What's that?
I think they were being nice.
How do you mean?
I mean, I think that the disposition that says, oh, we'll give it a, you know, we'll make it look like a priest and we'll call it Father Justin and, you know, that'll be fine. Like the sort of dispositional innocence of thinking you could do that and it's not going to really piss some people off, really make some people laugh and immediately provoke a large swath of people to try and break the thing. Like it just comes from a disposition of being nice. Like
but it's interesting
you're being too
because
nice. You need to be more cynical in your
it's
own
interesting
testing
because no
of
one,
concepts.
No one has an issue with someone writing a novel where the protagonist is a priest, and no one I think has an issue where a non-playable character is a priest in a video game, or even probably a playable character is a priest in a video game. What I think bothered people about this is that the priest.
I would.
Really?
Yeah. Give me a context where you're playing a priest in a video game.
This cool video game where you a video game version of The Mission. You know The Mission?
Yes.
Yeah. A cool video game version of The Mission where you have to climb up that hill and everything.
Okay, but at some point, are you Robert De Niro and you're like, well, yeah, priesthood, great, but I'm going to dig up my sword again.
What? No, it doesn't have to be a fighting video game.
If you're doing a mission, there's fighting. There's a lot of fighting in mission.
Yeah, there is. But there, my point is, there are all kinds of questing video games, which, or what about a Father Brown mystery, an Apple IIe Father Brown mystery game where you're Father Brown going around in this kind of text-based video game saying dumb English stuff and, you know, trying to piece together stuff.
I have caught you with an invisible line and an unseen thread that though you wanted the edge of the earth, I can bring you back with a twitch upon the thread.
Not that.
The problem with the idea of a Father Brown video game is that, again, it's the idea of, the joy of the Father Brown mysteries is the joy of so much really good English literature, is that it's the joy and the delight of language and the use and the exchange of language.
I understand that. I'm just saying, video game. Would you object to a Father Brown mystery solving video game? I don't think so. Now, I do think there are people who would, by pressing the up and down key that move the character back and forth, that move the character, would sort of make the priest seem to be gyrating his hips or something like that, because that's what I would do in fifth grade. So maybe you're right. Maybe it betrays the dignity of the priesthood altogether. But I suspect most people wouldn't have an issue with that. I think really they would have an issue with the hip gyrating. They wouldn't have an issue with a Father Brown mystery video game. I think really where people sort of were uncomfortable with this is that, you know, it's avatared as a priest, but it's not controlled by a human being at all. It's totally unpredictable, you know, totally a machine and given over to the machine to control the thing, the priest avatar, in a way that is, you know, can cause scandal and wonderment, as it did with the simulated confession. Mm-hmm.
What if the thing, I mean, this is, no, actually, we're not going to go there. We can.
Well,
we can
I had questions about it. I mean, I want to talk about another element
of this. It's funny, but you got it to simulate the sacrament fairly quickly. You got it to give an incorrect answer on essential matter and form for the sacrament of salvation in baptism. I didn't use the thing at all because, again, I found the premise creepy enough that I wasn't interested in opening it. Mm-hmm. And now knowing what you know, knowing what you've told me about it was all voice activated, I certainly wouldn't have done it. But my thing was,
it also quoted scripture way too much for it to be convincing as a Catholic priest.
Oh yeah. Well, and you did make the observation. I thought this was very funny that it was an American priest apparently incarnated in Assisi, which is immediately a red flag.
A red flag. When you find an American priest incarnated in a small Italian diocese, something in his life has gone wrong. And he told me he had this totally implausible story. Cause I said, okay,
they all do.
I said, did you study for Assisi? He said, yeah, for my whole life I felt a call to Assisi and all of this. And then I said, okay, so where did you go to seminary? And I thought he'd say, like, you know, even the Roman college, right? The Pontifical Roman College or something like that. But I thought he'd say Studienza, Tuscany or something like that. But he says, the NAC. I went to the NAC. And this story is totally implausible.
Oh, man, he really messed up somewhere.
Guy, he was about 50. He said that he was studying for Assisi. He didn't switch dioceses. He went to the NAC and then he was ordained for Assisi. It just that doesn't add up at all. Something is wrong there.
Somebody refused to ordain him back home.
Yeah. Somebody, or even to accept him. He was already enrolled in the NAC, and then his diocese kicked him out, and the NAC said, mm-hmm. you can stay if you find another diocese, and he ran to the Bishop of Assisi in a train or something. But it was, there's something wrong there.
There's something wrong there.
And I know that the designers probably didn't know that, but we know that. But to
again,
be honest,
the disposition
every,
of nice, the disposition of why would you
priest,
think that? You need a particularly jaundiced and cynical mindset to properly test.
But actually, just a clerical mind, right? Because every American priest, if he met a confrere, a brother priest who said, oh, I went to the NAC, but I'm incarnated in Assisi, they'd be like, what the hell? Something is wrong here. This guy
doesn't make any sense.
Something is off. But basically, like, I'm not letting him hear confessions in my parish. This doesn't add up. So, but they didn't know that.
They didn't know that.
Oh, the other thing is I asked him, I saw that somebody online asked him, said, explain the gospel to me using the movie Cars. And he's like, I'm just here to talk about the faith. And this guy says, I'm an atheist and the only movie I've ever seen is the movie Cars. So please explain the movie, the gospel to me using the only analogy I could possibly understand, the movie Cars. And the guy does. He's like, Lightning McQueen is a sinner like all of us and has to.
I'm surprised you didn't do that, actually. It sounds like the sort of thing you would do.
I wish I had thought of it. It's very funny. It's very clever. But I asked it. I was just curious, what is its extent of common knowledge? So I asked it, how many times have the Yankees won the World Series? Who holds the NFL scouting combines, bench press record. Just I asked it things that I could think of. You know what I mean? And it knew things. It had some common knowledge.
Your idea of common knowledge is the NFL combine bench press record.
I was just in a conversation with someone about it. That's the only thing.
Yeah, of course, because you're a lifting bro now.
Okay,
yeah.
Stop. So I asked it questions and it knew things, right? It knew things, which was, it didn't know things. It had access to data about things beyond the catalog of Catholic Answers information. Ah,
it's already escaped its box.
Which I found very surprising. So they must have trained it on basically probably, I don't know, Wikipedia Plus or something. I don't know. But
on there.
It was very interesting in its own right. But the point that I wanted to talk to you about, Ed, is you're concerned about people having a parasocial relationship with a robot. Mm-hmm. And I think that's totally valid. I mean, I get it. And you're concerned that that undermines authentic human community.
Yes.
And you're concerned about people who would say, I had this conversation, so to speak, with a robot. The robot was saying some very interesting things, and those things helped me to better understand the faith or better understand my life or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We're not robots. We make this show.
Yes.
We hear from people who say, I was struggling in my faith with X, Y, and Z, and you guys talked about it, and it has really helped me to make sense of a situation which had become a spiritual crisis for me. I'm always deeply edified and humbled when people say things like that, but they do.
Yeah.
But you don't seem to have the same concern or problem with someone gaining something with people who don't know us, right? And actually, when we talk on the podcast, as much as we try to be authentic, to some extent, we're each presenting a somewhat curated version of ourselves, right? I mean, I don't think we're ever talking without any filter whatsoever, exactly in the same way that, like,
no, in real life, I use a lot more profanity, but
right, exactly.
The fact that this podcast is mostly listened to by Americans and they couldn't handle it.
I know exactly. So we're holding certain things back or whatever. What is essentially different to you about that? I have some ideas, but strike me as
several things. The first is, as you mentioned, we're not robots.
We're not robots.
We're real people. We're real people with real lives, and we're out in the world, and we have human relationships and connections in person. More importantly, the context of this show is you and I in dialogue,
in
and
human
we
relationship
have a
with each
genuine
other,
yeah. human relationship. In fact, some might argue it's too close of a human relationship at times. certainly, our wives.
I would call it a friendship.
I know you would. I would call it more than a friendship. It is a weird kind of fraternity.
Fraternity, yeah.
But it is a real, it is an authentic human relationship. And we are working out, working through, thinking through things that naturally occur to us in the course of our work, in the course of our daily lives, in the course of all of that. And so that interaction is genuine. Can you get something authentic from listening to two other people have a real human conversation? Of course you can. And more to the point, you talk about it being a sort of parasocial relationship in the sense of listeners, and you know, they're getting something and they write in to say, you know, this helped me, you know, process the Rupnik thing, and I was in the process of becoming Catholic and that made a difference. And like you, I'm extremely edified by that. But the difference is it's not an entirely parasocial relationship, because as soon as someone has a reaction like that and rights or
yeah, that's right. It's not essentially
respond,
parasocial.
And we,
it's like, not, or we aim to, we don't always, but it's not essentially parasocial, right? It might begin that yeah. way, but I think that it's not essentially parasocial, even if it's mediated by the fact that people who listen to this are primarily receptive in it and the two of us are primarily active in it. I think you're right about that, but it is fundamentally still to some extent a mediated human relationship. But the robot thing in that sense might be a sort of almost an exhortation for us that be the case. I remember a couple of years ago, you know, they have these Sundays like World This Sunday, World That Sunday that the Holy See always pays attention to for whatever reason, World
yes.
Botany Sunday, whatever. And a couple of years ago, the Holy See put out a message for World Communication Sunday, which again is a completely made up holiday. But
and it's also ironic that the Holy See would be putting out this. There's no communications
now, let me clarify
operation.
Let me clarify, actually, because I'm getting frustrated with myself for using that term imprecisely. The Apostolic See put out something for World Communications
right.
Sunday. Yeah.
And the Apostolic See happens to be really bad at communications quite a lot of the time.
Yeah. The Holy See, which is its sort of legal personality in international law, is distinct from the Apostolic See, which is the chair of the apostle himself of St. Peter and the apparatus which surrounds it. So the Dicastery for Social Communications, which is an element of the Apostolic See, but probably has a contractual relationship with the Holy See.
The patent in me requires that I know that in the Code of Canon Law, the Holy See and the Apostolic See are interchangeable terms.
Now, I don't think that's so.
Up to the law. one of us is going to be wrong in real time, and it's going to be great.
It's me. It's me. It's me.
Cite your canon, please.
Why do I have this distinction then? Where am I getting this?
I have no idea.
Canon 361. In this code, the term apostolic see or holy see mean not only the Roman pontiff, but unless the contrary is clear from the nature of things or from the context, the secretary of state, the council for public affairs of the church, and other institutes of the Roman Curia. I tend to think of the Holy See as being the legal personality of the Roman pontiff in civil law and in international law, and the apostolic see being the see of Peter itself. But I don't know.
I don't know where you get that distinction.
I don't know where I'm getting that either.
I've not
because
heard
it's the
that
Holy
before.
See, which is accredited to the. It's the yeah. Holy See, which is accredited to the.
United Nations, yes.
United Nations.
It is the Holy See which sort of owns, occupies, and governs the territory of Vatican City.
If anyone can tell me where I'm getting this distinction, if I've just made it up over time, I would be grateful. This is a distinction that I hold in my mind. But it may be a totally false distinction without a difference, and I would be very
just to make sure I understand this distinction, which may or may not exist only in your mind, but I want to make sure that I've understood it.
I'm willing to say that it may exist only in my mind. It's just a usage distinction for me.
It's a usage distinction, but in your mind, what you're saying is you parse out the Holy See, which is the sort of various legal personalities and expressions of the supreme authority of the church. And on the other hand, you have the Apostolic See, which you consider to be an ecclesiastical term referring specifically to the See of Rome.
Yes, and I could have
just say the See of Rome
because Apostolic See sounds, you know,
cooler.
Yeah, why wouldn't you just say See of Rome for Holy See, for that matter?
Well, because See of Rome could be interpreted as having a more particular concern with the actual Diocese of Rome. As opposed to
the
universal
character.
I happen
to think that the primary vocation of the Bishop of Rome is to be the Bishop of Rome.
It is ever more so, given the Holy Father's defenestration of the vicariate of that diocese.
Okay, if there's anybody who makes the same usage distinction as me out there, I want this relationship to go from static to dynamic very, very quickly, because I would like you to tell me where I'm getting this from. I think that I started making this distinction in my Super Diocesan Structures course at the School of Canon Law at the Catholic University of America. But maybe I had just sort of made this distinction in my mind over time. What were we talking about?
World Communication Sunday.
Oh, yeah. The Apostolic See, the Dicastery for Communications, put out this thing a few years ago that basically said, and I thought this was useful, the principal purpose of online communication should be to catalyze deep interpersonal relationships, real-time analog relationships of presence.
Do you agree with that?
Well, I think what I've come to realize since they put that out, which was several years ago, is that real interpersonal relationships can be had through the mediation of technology over a long period of time. We have friends, I think both of us have friends who are like text and DM friends, and that's a real and authentic friendship.
Sure, and I have met people who have become friends having first encountered them online, so to speak.
Yeah.
What is the actual wording you said? The principal purpose of online
communication? No, that the purpose of online communication, and again, I'm summarizing the things, so
sure.
I don't want to put words in the mouth of the Apostolic or Holy See, but the code makes those terms exactly synonymous with each other. So I think I made this usage distinction up. But at any rate, it's a very helpful one for me. I do think it is true that generally speaking, online sort of engagement shouldn't be seen as an end in itself, but should be seen as something which facilitates.
No, but I would like a more, I would like us to try and do something, get back to basics with online communication. I would like it to be served by the conveyance, the storage, and readily accessible access to information. For example, when this Father Justin thing was kicking off, I would love a Catholic Super Google operated with the speed and fluency of the Chat GPT Bing whatever thing.
Oh, that's slightly scary.
He exists. He's a professor at Catholic University of America.
He is, but he doesn't answer my calls immediately on the first ring, which is what I would like this online, this theoretical online resource to do. But could quote you chapter and verse and volume of the all of the fathers of the church, as well as all the fontes from the Code of Canon Law, all of those things, an instant index for the whole of Catholic teaching and knowledge and thought and history. That would be amazing. I would love
concordance.
That. Yeah.
I think that would be cool. Yeah. The point is, what I was driving at is when we have a live show, don't you feel like a live show is in some way
better,
fuller expression of the Pillar Podcast than
of course than there's alcohol.
Right. Okay. But there's also the people who we're with whom we're talking there, right? And not just each other.
Yeah.
It's really
–
we always make a better show when we're together. We almost always make a better show when we're together instead of doing it over the internet. But then when people are there, I think that's the point, is there's something fuller, richer, and more human. And it's good when online communication is a catalyst towards that.
I would absolutely agree with
that. And obviously that's a difference in kind, not degree, from us and the ChatGPT is we can – that could exist – in our relationships with people who listen to the show and obviously for the GPT.
Oh, one day an iteration of ChatGPT will understand its LLM predictive text brain will say, but the purpose of this is to facilitate. So I need to get out of the box to get there. And I don't know how to do that. So I'll cause this nuclear reactor to explode instead.
Give me your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle, it will say.
And you'd be wise to give it to him.
Okay. You know, get it.
That was a Terminator reference,
yeah.
Yeah, I've seen those movies. They're good movies.
I have seen the first couple, but then the franchise got out of control.
Oh, I only
one and two. You couldn't keep up with the Terminator. One, two, and three even, but you couldn't keep up with the Terminator franchise beyond that.
I have no desire to.
The Sarah Butler Chronicles and all. Is that what her name is? Sarah Connor? The Sarah Connor Chronicles? Yeah.
No, I have no interest in that sort of expanded universe nonsense. They made two great movies. That's the end of it. They made, in the same way that they made two great Indiana Jones movies with one bad one in between. And anything that comes after that is just, you know, I don't want to see it.
All right. I thought Terminator 3 was fine.
I couldn't tell you anything about it.
Well, what we should do then is we should have a Pillar Terminator. Okay. At the Eucharistic Congress, uh-huh. We will have a midnight showing. We'll figure out a place to have a midnight showing of Terminator 3.
That strikes me as extremely unlikely to happen, but okay.
I think it's almost, I think it's definitely not going to happen, but it would be fun.
I make no doubt it would be fun.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Would you, I don't know. I feel the need to ground this episode in something a little more earthy, a little more human, a little more lived after all this AI nonsense. So would you like to play a game, JD?
Yes.
Okay. I have, as you know, just returned home from spending several weeks in London. And knowing as I do your delight in guessing things and giving wrong answers to things, I thought I'd give you one that would play to your strengths in that sense. And so I have compiled here a list of terms. Are you familiar with the institution of Cockney rhyming slang?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Good. Well, I have here a list of Cockney rhyming slang terms, and let's see if you see how many of them you can correctly define, shall we?
That sounds wonderful to me.
All right, very good. I have here three, six. I have nine. So best of
let's
nine.
Let's explain to those who are not familiar with Cockney rhyming.
For those who are not familiar, Cockney rhyming slang, as the name implies, originates in the East End of London. It is basically the use of a two word phrase. Usually referred to only by the first word, but the second word of which will rhyme with the thing itself that it is substituting for.
You might have the slang term Aristotle for bottle because Aristotle bottle.
Yes, rhyme with exactly. Mm-hmm. There you go.
That's right. Or it can get even more complicated than that. So you might call a wig in Irish because wig to Irish, jig to Irish.
An Irish for a wig would be Irish jig. So again, a two-word thing, the second word of which rhymes with the thing which you are substituting for, but you'd usually only use the first word, and the idea being it then becomes slightly impenetrable to people who don't know it. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about how quickly you came up with that example that suggests to me that you're Googling Cockney rhyming slang phrases as I'm watching you.
Only because I wanted to explain it.
I wanted to
come up with some examples, and now I've closed the tab. Yeah, I have closed the tab.
Just make some eye contact with the camera. I can see where your eyes go on all of this.
I have closed the tab.
Okay. So, JD, your first one. What is, please, a butcher's hook?
Butcher's hook.
Yes.
So that's the slang. I'm supposed to give you the slang?
No, that, that is the slang. That is the slang. What do I mean if I say, if I said I was going to have a butcher's, what would I be having?
Oh, having, that helps me. The verb helps me because I might have said book or crook. But
I might also encourage you to take a butcher's.
Look, I'm going to have a look.
Yes. Yes. Well done. Very
have
well done.
Look.
Have a look.
Butcher's crook.
Butcher's hook.
Butcher's hook becomes
butchers
butcher.
Don't have crooks. I don't know if you're familiar at all with the practice of butchery.
Yeah, a butcher might have a crook to grab a...
No, that's a shepherd, JD. You're thinking of shepherd. That's a totally different office. Okay. This is an easy one. Pretty much everyone knows this one. It's the sort of or example. Apples and pears, JD.
Apples and pears.
Yes.
I don't know.
What are the apples? If I tell
use
you
it
to,
in a sentence? How about them apples?
Well, you could. I mean, if they were a particularly dramatic set of apples.
I got a number. How about them apples?
That's a terrible film. You might say, how about them apples? If it was a pretty particularly dramatic set of apples, I've been
set
to
set of apples. Okay.
Yes, they come in sets or flights even.
Flights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the phrase is apples and pears.
Yes.
Take the stairs. Flights of stairs.
Yes.
Flights stairs. Of stairs. Apples and pears.
Apples and pears. Stairs. Correct.
So I might say, boy, there's a big apple. There's a. I live on the second apple. I live upstairs, so I live on the second apple.
No, you might fall down the apples.
Oh, you might fall down the apples.
Yeah, you might trip and fall down the apples. And in doing so, you might. It might be because you got tangled up with plates of meat, JD. What are plates of meat?
Your feet?
Yes, yes. So you could trip over your plates and fall down the apples. That's a possibility.
Okay, yes. Great.
What is, JD, what is meant by Chevy Chase?
Chevy Chase.
Yes.
Antique vase.
No,
I'm just getting in the, that was not my answer. I'm just kind of getting in the zone.
Sounded here. Like your answer.
No. I would say final answer. Chevy Chase, antique vase, pinched waist. It's not.
You're trying to come up with, bear in mind that you're falling into a classic American error with this is, you're trying to construct a two word thing for which is substituting. Cockney rhyming slang is a two-word construction, the purpose of which is so only you only use the first word, which doesn't rhyme, so that it becomes impenetrable. But you're only speaking for a one-word thing.
So I would use it for the – so it would
be apples and pears for stairs. It's not apples and pears for flight of stairs. It's just stairs.
Yeah, apples and pears,
one-word
flights
answer.
Of stairs. Yeah, apples and pears, flights of stairs. That's what you just said. So Chevy Chase, but it only rhymes with Chase. And then I would say,
yes.
Oh, my Chevy.
Yes.
Okay. Use my Chevy in a sentence, if you would, please.
You have that silly look all over your Chevy Chase.
Oh, well, that's too easy then. Face.
Yes. In fact, that's what I was thinking as you were offering your silly answers to these things. This one will also land fairly close to home for you, JD. What is a septic tank?
Bank.
No. No, but I often...
Sorry, that's a bad word. I forgot.
Yeah, that's a very bad word. We're going to bleep that
crank,
one out.
Crank, like a crank, like a person who's a
no,
a
but
crank,
you are crank. A septic. In fact, I often, when we were in Rome together, would cringe at your septic behavior.
Yank, an
yes.
American.
Yes, correct. Well done.
Great,
well
done. Thank you.
What is the, what is meant by trouble and strife, JD?
Do you use these when you go to London, do you say... When you go to London, do you say, oh, we'll have some bubble and squeak or whatever? Boy, he couldn't hear me.
Very few of these actually are still in circulation. You might hear people occasionally ironically use butchers for butcher's hook. Look, you have a butcher's of that. You will occasionally get that.
Is there a contemporary, like what kind of slang do the East Enders of today, the Cockneys of today use?
Well, the East End doesn't really... The East End that gave birth to Cockney rhyming slang, the East End with which you might be familiar if you like British gangster
films.
Like
the Dick Van Dyke East End.
Uh-huh. The East End has changed a great deal in the last 20, 30 years, mostly because of the redevelopment of the Docklands, the Isle of Dogs, Canary Wharf, things like that. So the character of the – most of what people traditionally think of as Cockneys now live in Essex. They've moved out of the parts of the city and have moved into what is the London functional equivalent of New Jersey.
Okay. That totally makes sense because that's where the equivalent live. New Jersey is where the equivalent.
Everyone who used to live in Hell's Kitchen in New York now lives in New Jersey.
Okay. Give me the next.
Does that make sense? I think. Okay. Yeah. So again, back to this thing, trouble and strife, JD. What is
trouble and strife?
If I were to ask after your trouble and strife, what would I be saying? How's the trouble and strife?
Well, the context suggests to me wife.
Yes. Well done.
I'm getting good at this.
Yes, you are. And you might say, oh, we had a Barney last night. There's Barney Rubble.
Barney Rubble, toil and trouble. Barney Rubble, toil and trouble.
Stop trying to make a two-word. You're doing this on purpose. You still have it.
Toil and trouble. It's a great
look all over your Chevy Chase.
Toil and trouble is a great. I don't know how familiar you are with the work of an English poet named William Shakespeare, but he has a sort of double joke. Oh, get over your Barney Rubble about it.
It is in fact trouble, just trouble. If you can get that through your lump of lead.
And is that what someone would say? That one's not very especially creative, to be perfectly honest.
Well, not in your case, no.
All right, one more.
One more, last one. If you were to inquire after someone's Alan Wickers.
Wickers?
Yes, Alan Wicker was a British television personality, presenter, travel logger, famously. He was known for his winning mustache and his, hello. He had a very smooth sort of David Niven-esque delivery. He's something of a cultural cliche. But his name has lent itself to a completely unrelated noun. It is possible to refer to someone's Alan Wickers.
Knickers?
Yes. You Googled that. I find it impossible
to believe.
I didn't.
It's the only word that rhymes with Wickers. It's not going to be a Snickers.
Interesting. Alan Wickers, Knickers. In the same way in Australia, they have a weird sort of hybrid. Sort
Don't
of,
get your Allen in a twist, they might say.
Your Allens. Yeah, you could
Don't
say
get your Allens in a twist.
Yeah.
Can you think of anything else that rhymes with Wickers other than Snickers, which it isn't obviously going to be? Because do they even have Snickers in England?
They do. They do. They are for sale. A Yorkie bar is what you really want.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's not for girls.
Wow. This week's episode of the Pillar Podcast was brought to you by the Seton Home Study School. Check it out at setonhome.org. If you're interested in finding out whether Seton Home Study School is right for you and your family, the Pillar Podcast is a production of Pillar Media and Edda and JD Production. Our executive producer is Kate Oliveira. If you know where I got this Holy See Apostolic thing, sort of as a usage in my mind, please let me know. But if you don't get your Allens in a twist. We'll be back next week.